dramatic, a coup de théâtre had its advantages for the Orient as well. This country, which has transmitted its knowledge to so many nations, is today plunged into barbarism. Only a hero could bring all these factors together, which is what Fourier now describes. Napoleon appreciated the influence that this event would have on the relations between Europe, the Orient, and Africa, on Mediterranean shipping, and on Asia's destiny. Napoleon wanted to offer a useful European example to the Orient, and finally also to make the inhabitants' lives more pleasant, as well as to procure for them all the advantages of a perfected civilization. None of this would be possible without a continuous application to the project of the arts and sciences. To restore a region from its present barbarism to its former classical greatness. To instruct, for its own benefit, the Orient in the ways of the modern West. To subordinate or underplay military power in order to aggrandize the project of glorious knowledge acquired in the process of political domination of the Orient, to formulate the Orient, to give it shape, identity, definition with full recognition of its place in memory, its importance to imperial strategy, and its natural role as an appendage to Europe. To dignify all the knowledge collected during colonial occupation with the title Contribution to Modern Learning, when the natives had neither been consulted nor treated as anything except as pretexts for a text whose usefulness was not to the natives. To feel oneself as a European in command, almost at will, of Oriental history, time, and geography. To institute new areas of specialization. To establish new disciplines, to divide, deploy, schematize, tabulate, index, and record everything in sight and out of sight, to make out of every observable detail a generalization, and out of every generalization an immutable law about the Oriental nature, temperament, mentality, custom, or type, and, above all, to transmute living reality into the stuff of texts, to possess, or think one possesses, actuality, mainly because nothing in the Orient seems to resist one's powers. These are the features of Orientalist projection entirely realized in the Description de l'Égypte, itself enabled and reinforced by Napoleon's wholly Orientalist engulfment of Egypt by the instruments of Western knowledge and power. Thus, Fourier concludes his preface by announcing that history will remember how Égypte fut le théâtre de sa, Napoleon's, gloire, et préserve de l'oubli toutes les circonstances de cet événement extraordinaire. The description thereby displaces Egyptian or Oriental history as a history possessing its own coherence, identity, and sense. Instead, history as recorded in the description supplants Egyptian or Oriental history by identifying itself directly and immediately with world history, a euphemism for European history. To save an event from oblivion is, in the Orientalist's mind, the equivalent of turning the Orient into a theater for his representations of the Orient. This is almost exactly what Fourier says. Moreover, the sheer power of having described the Orient in modern Occidental terms lifts the Orient from the realms of silent obscurity where it has lain neglected, except for the inchoate murmurings of a vast but undefined sense of its own past, into the clarity of modern European science. There, this new Orient figures as, for instance, in Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire's biological theses in the Description, the confirmation of laws of zoological specialization formulated by Buffon. Or it serves as a contraste frappant avec les habitudes des nations européennes, in which the bizarre jouissance of Orientals serve to highlight the sobriety and rationality of Occidental habits. Or, to cite one more use for the Orient, equivalents of those oriental physiological characteristics that made possible the successful embalming of bodies, are sought for in European bodies, so that chevaliers fallen on the field of honor can be preserved as lifelike relics of Napoleon's great oriental campaign. Yet the military failure of Napoleon's occupation of Egypt did not also destroy the fertility of its overall projection for Egypt or the rest of the Orient. Quite literally, the occupation gave birth to the entire modern experience of the Orient as interpreted from within the universe of discourse founded by Napoleon in Egypt, whose agencies of domination and dissemination included the Institut and the Description. The idea, as it has been characterized by Charles Roux, was that Egypt, restored to prosperity, regenerated by wise and enlightened administration, would shed its civilizing rays upon all its Oriental neighbors. True, the other European powers would seek to compete in this mission, none more than England, but what would happen as a continuing legacy of the common Occidental mission to the Orient, despite inter-European squabbling, indecent competition, or outright war, would be the creation of new projects, new visions, new enterprises combining additional parts of the old Orient with the conquering European spirit. After Napoleon, then, the very language of Orientalism changed radically. Its descriptive realism was upgraded and became not merely a style of representation, but a language, indeed a means of creation. Along with the Langue Mère, as those forgotten dormant sources for the modern European demotics were entitled by Antoine Fabre d'Olivet, the Orient was reconstructed, reassembled, crafted, in short, born out of the Orientalists' efforts. The Description became the master type of all further efforts to bring the Orient closer to Europe, thereafter to absorb it entirely and, centrally important, to cancel, or at least subdue and reduce, its strangeness, and in the case of Islam, its hostility. For the Islamic Orient would henceforth appear as a category denoting the Orientalists' power, and not the Islamic people as humans, nor their history as history. Thus, out of the Napoleonic expedition, there issued a whole series of textual children, from Chateaubriand's Itinéraire to Lamartine's Voyage en Orient to Flaubert's Salammbô, and in the same tradition, Lane's Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians and Richard Burton's Personal Narrative of a Pilgrimage to Al-Madina and Mecca. What binds them together is not only their common background in Oriental legend and experience, but also their learned reliance on the Orient as a kind of womb out of which they were brought forth. If, paradoxically, these creations turned out to be highly stylized simulacra, elaborately wrought imitations of what a live Orient might be thought to look like, that by no means detracts either from the strength of their imaginative conception or from the strength of European mastery of the Orient, whose prototypes respectively were Cagliostro, the great European impersonator of the Orient, and Napoleon, its first modern conqueror. Artistic or textual work was not the only product of the Napoleonic expedition. There were, in addition and certainly more influential, the scientific project, whose chief instance is Ernest Renan's Système comparé et histoire générale des langues sémitiques, completed in 1848 for, neatly enough, the Prix Volney, and the geopolitical project, of which Ferdinand de Lesseps' Suez Canal and England's occupation of Egypt in 1882 are prime instances. The difference between the two is not only in manifest scale, but also in quality of Orientalist conviction. Renan truly believed that he had recreated the Orient as it really was in his work. De Lesseps, on the other hand, always was somewhat awed by the newness his project had released out of the old Orient and this sense communicated itself to everyone for whom the opening of the canal in 1869 was no ordinary event. In his Excursionist and Tourist Advisor for July 1, 1869, Thomas Cook's enthusiasm carries on de Lesseps. On November the 17th, the greatest engineering feat of the present century is to have its success celebrated by a magnificent inauguration fete at which nearly every European royal family will have its special representative. Truly, the occasion will be an exceptional one, the formation of a line of water communication between Europe and the East has been the thought of centuries, occupying in turn the minds of Greeks, Roman, Saxon, and Gaul. But it was not until within the last few years that modern civilization began seriously to set about emulating the labors of the ancient pharaohs, who, many centuries since, constructed a canal between the two seas, traces of which remain to this day. Everything connected with the modern works are on the most gigantic scale, and a perusal of a little pamphlet, descriptive of the undertaking, from the pen of the Chevalier de Saint-Stress, impresses us most forcibly with the genius of the great mastermind, Monsieur Ferdinand de Lesseps, to whose perseverance, calm, daring, and foresight, the dream of ages has at last become a real and tangible fact. The project for bringing more closely together the countries of the West and the East, and thus uniting the civilizations of different epochs. The combination of old ideas with new methods, the bringing together of cultures whose relations to the 19th century were different, the genuine imposition of the power of modern technology and intellectual will upon formerly stable and divided geographical entities like East and West, this is what Cook perceives, and what, in his journals, speeches, prospectuses, and letters, de Lesseps advertises. Genealogically, Ferdinand's start was auspicious. Mathieu de Lesseps, his father, had come to Egypt with Napoleon and remained there, as unofficial French representative, Marlowe says, for 4 years after the French evacuated it in 1801. Many of Ferdinand's later writings refer back to Napoleon's own interest in digging a canal, which, because he had been misinformed by experts, he never thought was a realizable goal. Infected by the erratic history of canal projects that included French schemes entertained by Richelieu and the Saint-Simonians, de Lesseps returned to Egypt in 1854, there to embark on the undertaking that was eventually completed 15 years later. He had no real engineering background, only a tremendous faith in his near-divine skills as builder, mover, and creator kept him going, as his diplomatic and financial talents gained him Egyptian and European support. He seems to have acquired the necessary knowledge to carry matters to completion. More useful, perhaps, he learned how to plant his potential contributors in the world historical theater and make them see what his pensée morale, as he called his project, really meant. Vous envisagez, he told them in 1860, les immenses services que le rapprochement de l'Occident et de l'Orient doit rendre à la civilisation et au développement de la richesse générale. Le monde attend de vous un grand progrès, et vous voulez répondre à l'attente du monde. In accordance with such notions, the name of the investment company formed by de Lesseps in 1858 was a charged one, and reflected the grandiose plans he cherished. The Compagnie Universelle. In 1862, the Académie Française offered a prize for an epic on the canal. Bornier, the winner, delivered himself of such hyperbole as the following, none of it fundamentally contradicting de Lesseps' picture of what he was up to. Au travail, ouvrier que notre France envoie, tracé pour l'univers cette nouvelle voie. Vos pères, les héros, sont venus jusqu'ici. Soyez fermes comme aux intrépides. Comme eux, vous combattez au pied des pyramides. Et leurs 4000 ans vous contemplent aussi. Puis c'est pour l'univers, pour l'Asie et l'Europe, pour ces climats lointains que la nuit enveloppe, pour le Chinois perfide et l'Indien diminu, pour les peuples heureux, libres, humains et braves, pour les peuples méchants, pour les peuples esclaves, pour ceux à qui le cri est encore inconnu. De Lesseps was nowhere more eloquent and resourceful than when he was called upon to justify the enormous expense in money and men the canal would require. He could pour out statistics to enchant any ear. He would quote Herodotus and maritime statistics with equal fluency. In his journal entries for 1864, he cited with approbation Casimir Lecomte's observation that an eccentric life would develop significant originality in men, and from originality would come great and unusual exploits. Such exploits were their own justification. Despite its immemorial pedigree of failures, its outrageous cost, its astounding ambitions for altering the way Europe would handle the Orient, the canal was worth the effort. It was a project uniquely able to override the objections of those who were consulted, and, in improving the Orient as a whole, to do what scheming Egyptians, perfidious Chinese, and half-naked Indians could never have done for themselves. The opening ceremonies in November 1869 were an occasion which, no less than the whole history of de Lesseps' machinations, perfectly embodied his ideas. For years, his speeches, letters, and pamphlets were laden with a vividly energetic and theatrical vocabulary. In the pursuit of success, he could be found saying of himself, always in the first person plural, "We created, fought, disposed, achieved, acted, recognized, persevered, advanced. Nothing," he repeated on many occasions, "could stop us. Nothing was impossible. Nothing mattered, finally, except the realization of le résultat final, le grand but," which he had conceived, defined, and finally executed. As the papal envoy to the ceremonies spoke on November 16th to the assembled dignitaries, his speech strove desperately to match the intellectual and imaginative spectacle offered by de Lesseps' canal. "Il est permis d'affirmer que l'heure qui vient de sonner est non seulement une des plus solennelles de ce siècle, mais encore une des plus grandes et des plus décisives qu'ait vue l'humanité depuis qu'elle a une histoire si bas. Ce lieu, où confine, sans désormais y toucher, l'Afrique et l'Asie, cette grande fête du genre humain, cette assistance auguste et cosmopolite, toutes les races du globe, tous les drapeaux, tous les pavillons, flottant joyeusement sous le ciel radieux et immense, la croix debout et respectée de tout son face du croissant, que de merveilles, que de contrastes saisissants, que de rêves réputés chimériques devenus de palpables réalités, et, dans cet assemblage de tant de prodiges, que de sujets de réflexion pour le penseur, que de joie dans l'heure présente et dans les perspectives de l'avenir, que de glorieuses espérances. Les deux extrémités du globe se rapprochent. En se rapprochant, elles se reconnaissent. En se reconnaissant, tous les hommes, enfants d'un seul et même Dieu, éprouvent le tressaillement joyeux de leur mutuelle fraternité. Ô Occident, ô Orient, rapprochez, regardez, reconnaissez, saluez, étreignez-vous. Mais derrière le phénomène matériel, le regard du penseur découvre des horizons plus vastes que les espaces mesurables, les horizons sans bornes où mouvent les plus hautes destinées, les plus glorieuses conquêtes, les plus immortelles certitudes du genre humain. Dieu, que votre souffle divin plane sur ces eaux, qu'il y passe et repasse de l'Occident à l'Orient, de l'Orient à l'Occident. Ô Dieu, servez-vous de cette voie pour rapprocher les hommes les uns des autres. The whole world seemed crowded in to render homage to a scheme that God could only bless and make use of himself. Old distinctions and inhibitions were dissolved. The cross faced down the crescent. The West had come to the Orient, never to leave it. Until, in July 1956, Gamal Abdel Nasser would activate Egypt's taking over of the canal by pronouncing the name of De Lesseps. In the Suez Canal idea, we see the logical conclusion of Orientalist thought and, more interesting, of Orientalist effort. To the West, Asia had once represented silent distance and alienation. Islam was militant hostility to European Christianity. To overcome such redoubtable constants, the Orient needed first to be known, then invaded and possessed, then recreated by scholars, soldiers, and judges who disinterred forgotten languages, histories, races, and cultures in order to posit them beyond the modern Orientals' ken as the true classical Orient that could be used to judge and rule the modern Orient. The obscurity faded to be replaced by hothouse entities. The Orient was a scholar's word, signifying what modern Europe had recently made of the still peculiar East. De Lesseps and his canal finally destroyed the Orient's distance, its cloistered intimacy away from the West, its perdurable exoticism. Just as a land barrier could be transmuted into a liquid artery, so too the Orient was transubstantiated from resistant hostility into obliging and submissive partnership. After De Lesseps, no one could speak of the Orient as belonging to another world, strictly speaking. There was only our world, one world bound together because the Suez Canal had frustrated those last provincials who still believed in the difference between worlds. Thereafter, the notion of Oriental is an administrative or executive one, and it is subordinate to demographic, economic, and sociological factors. For imperialists like Balfour, or for anti-imperialists like J.A. Hobson, the Oriental, like the African, is a member of a subject race and not exclusively an inhabitant of a geographical area. De Lesseps had melted away the Orient's geographical identity by, almost literally, dragging the Orient into the West and finally dispelling the threat of Islam. New categories and experiences, including the imperialist ones, would emerge, and in time, Orientalism would adapt itself to them, but not without some difficulty. 4. Crisis. It may appear strange to speak about something or someone as holding a textual attitude, but a student of literature will understand the phrase more easily if he will recall the kind of view attacked by Voltaire in Candide, or even the attitude to reality satirized by Cervantes in Don Quixote. What seems unexceptionable good sense to these writers is that it is a fallacy to assume that the swarming, unpredictable, and problematic mess in which human beings live can be understood on the basis of what books, texts, say. To apply what one learns out of a book literally to reality is to risk folly or ruin. One would no more think of using Amadis of Gaul to understand 16th century or present-day Spain than one would use the Bible to understand, say, the House of Commons. But clearly, people have tried and do try to use texts in so simple-minded a way, for otherwise Candide and Don Quixote would not still have the appeal for readers that they do today. It seems a common human failing to prefer the schematic authority of a text to the disorientations of direct encounters with the human. But is this failing constantly present, or are there circumstances that, more than others, make the textual attitude likely to prevail? Two situations favor a textual attitude. One is when a human being confronts at close quarters something relatively unknown and threatening and previously distant. In such a case, one has recourse not only to what in one's previous experience the novelty resembles, but also to what one has read about it. travel books or guidebooks are about as natural a kind of text, as logical in their composition and in their use, as any book one can think of, precisely because of this human tendency to fall back on a text when the uncertainties of travel in strange parts seem to threaten one's equanimity. Many travelers find themselves saying of an experience in a new country that it wasn't what they expected, meaning that it wasn't what a book said it would be. And of course, many writers of travel books or guidebooks compose them in order to say that a country is like this, or better, that it is colorful, expensive, interesting, and so forth. The idea in either case is that people, places, and experiences can always be described by a book, so much so that the book or text acquires a greater authority and use even than the actuality it describes. The comedy of Fabrice Del Dongo's search for the Battle of Waterloo is not so much that he fails to find the battle, but that he looks for it as something texts have told him about. A second situation favoring the textual attitude is the appearance of success. If one reads a book claiming that lions are fierce and then encounters a fierce lion, I simplify, of course, the chances are that one will be encouraged to read more books by that same author and believe them. But if, in addition, the lion book instructs one how to deal with a fierce lion and the instructions work perfectly, then not only will the author be greatly believed, he will also be impelled to try his hand at other kinds of written performance. There is a rather complex dialectic of reinforcement by which the experiences of readers in reality are determined by what they have read, and this, in turn, influences writers to take up subjects defined in advance by readers' experiences. A book on how to handle a fierce lion might then cause a series of books to be produced on such subjects as the fierceness of lions, the origins of fierceness, and so forth. Similarly, as the focus of the text centers more narrowly on the subject, no longer lions, but their fierceness, we might expect that the ways by which it is recommended that a lion's fierceness be handled will actually increase its fierceness, force it to be fierce, since that is what it is, and that is what, in essence, we know or can only know about it. A text purporting to contain knowledge about something actual and arising out of circumstances similar to the ones I have just described is not easily dismissed. Expertise is attributed to it. The authority of academics, institutions, and governments can accrue to it, surrounding it with still greater prestige than its practical successes warrant. Most important, such texts can create not only knowledge, but also the very reality they appear to describe. In time, such knowledge and reality produce a tradition, or what Michel Foucault calls a discourse, whose material presence or weight, not the originality of a given author, is really responsible for the texts produced out of it. This kind of text is composed out of those pre-existing units of information deposited by Flaubert in the catalogue of Idées Reçues. In the light of all this, consider Napoleon and de Lesseps. Everything they knew, more or less, about the Orient came from books written in the tradition of Orientalism, placed in its library of Idées Reçues. For them, the Orient, like the fierce lion, was something to be encountered and dealt with to a certain extent because the texts made that Orient possible. Such an Orient was silent, available to Europe for the realization of projects that involved but were never directly responsible to the native inhabitants, and unable to resist the projects, images, or mere descriptions devised for it. Earlier in this chapter, I called such a relation between Western writing and its consequences and Oriental silence the result of and the sign of the West's great cultural strength, its will to power over the Orient. But there is another side to the strength, a side whose existence depends on the pressures of the Orientalist tradition and its textual attitude to the Orient. This side lives its own life, as books about fierce lions will do until lions can talk back. The perspective rarely drawn on Napoleon and de Lesseps, to take two among the many projectors who hatched plans for the Orient, is the one that sees them carrying on in the dimensionless silence of the Orient, mainly because the discourse of Orientalism, over and above the Orient's powerlessness to do anything about them, suffused their activity with meaning, intelligibility, and reality. The discourse of Orientalism and what made it possible, in Napoleon's case, a West far more powerful militarily than the Orient, gave them Orientals who could be described in such works as the Description de l'Égypte, and an Orient that could be cut across as de Lesseps cut across Suez. Moreover, Orientalism gave them their success, at least from their point of view, which had nothing to do with that of the Oriental. Success, in other words, had all the actual human interchange between Oriental and Westerner of the judges, said I to myself, said I, in trial by jury. Once we begin to think of Orientalism as a kind of Western projection onto and will to govern over the Orient, we will encounter few surprises. For if it is true that historians like Michelet, Ranke, Tocqueville, and Burckhardt emplot their narratives as a story of a particular kind, the same is also true of Orientalists who plotted Oriental history, character, and destiny for hundreds of years. During the 19th and 20th centuries, the Orientalists became a more serious quantity, because by then the reaches of imaginative and actual geography had shrunk, because the Oriental-European relationship was determined by an unstoppable European expansion in search of markets, resources, and colonies, and finally, because Orientalism had accomplished its self-metamorphosis from a scholarly discourse to an imperial institution. Evidence of this metamorphosis is already apparent in what I have said of Napoleon, de Lesseps, Balfour, and Cromer. Their projects in the Orient are understandable on only the most rudimentary level as the efforts of men of vision and genius, heroes, in Carlyle's sense. In fact, Napoleon, de Lesseps, Cromer, and Balfour are far more regular, far less unusual, if we recall the schemata of d'Herbelot and Dante, and add to them both a modernized, efficient engine, like the 19th-century European Empire, and a positive twist. Since one cannot ontologically obliterate the Orient, as d'Herbelot and Dante perhaps realized, one does have the means to capture it, treat it, describe it, improve it, radically alter it. The point I am trying to make here is that the transition from a merely textual apprehension, formulation, or definition of the Orient to the putting of all this into practice in the Orient did take place, and that Orientalism had much to do with that, if I may use the word in a literal sense, preposterous transition. So far as its strictly scholarly work was concerned, and I find the idea of strictly scholarly work as disinterested and abstract hard to understand, still we can allow it intellectually, Orientalism did a great many things. During its great age in the 19th century, it produced scholars. It increased the number of languages taught in the West and the quantity of manuscripts edited, translated, and commented on. In many cases, it provided the Orient with sympathetic European students, genuinely interested in such matters as Sanskrit grammar, Phoenician numismatics, and Arabic poetry. Yet, and here we must be very clear, Orientalism overrode the Orient. As a system of thought about the Orient, it always rose from the specifically human detail to the general transhuman one. An observation about a 10th century Arab poet multiplied itself into a policy towards and about the Oriental mentality in Egypt, Iraq, or Arabia. Similarly, a verse from the Quran would be considered the best evidence of an ineradicable Muslim sensuality. Orientalism assumed an unchanging Orient, absolutely different, the reasons change from epoch to epoch, from the West. And Orientalism, in its post-18th century form, could never revise itself. All this makes Cromer and Balfour, as observers and administrators of the Orient, inevitable. The closeness between politics and Orientalism, or, to put it more circumspectly, the great likelihood that ideas about the Orient drawn from Orientalism can be put to political use, is an important yet extremely sensitive truth. It raises questions about the predisposition towards innocence or guilt, scholarly disinterest or pressure group complicity in such fields as black or women's studies. It necessarily provokes unrest in one's conscience about cultural, racial, or historical generalizations, their uses, value, degree of objectivity, and fundamental intent. More than anything else, the political and cultural circumstances in which Western Orientalism has flourished draw attention to the debased position of the Orient or Oriental as an object of study. Can any other than a political master-slave relation produce the Orientalized Orient perfectly characterized by Anwar Abdul Malik? A. On the level of the position of the problem and the problematic, the Orient and Orientals are considered by Orientalism as an object of study, stamped with an otherness as all that is different, whether it be subject or object, but of a constitutive otherness, of an essentialist character. This object of study will be, as is customary, passive, non-participating, endowed with a historical subjectivity, above all, non-active, non-autonomous, non-sovereign with regard to itself. The only Orient or Oriental or subject which could be admitted at the extreme limit is the alienated being, philosophically, that is, other than itself in relationship to itself, posed, understood, defined, and acted by others. B. On the level of the thematic, the Orientalists adopt an essentialist conception of the countries, nations, and peoples of the Orient under study, a conception which expresses itself through a characterized ethnist typology, and will soon proceed with it towards racism. According to the traditional Orientalists, an essence should exist, sometimes even clearly described in metaphysical terms, which constitutes the inalienable and common basis of all the beings considered. This essence is both historical, since it goes back to the dawn of history, and fundamentally ahistorical, since it transfixes the being, the object of study, within its inalienable and non-evolutive specificity, instead of defining it as all other beings, states, nations, peoples, and cultures, as a product, a resultant of the vection of the forces operating in the field of historical evolution. Thus, one ends with a typology, based on a real specificity, but detached from history, and consequently conceived as being intangible, essential, which makes of the studied object another being with regard to whom the studying subject is transcendent. We will have a Homo Sinicus, a Homo Arabicus, and why not a Homo Egypticus, etc., a Homo Africanus, the man, the normal man, it is understood, being the European man of the historical period, that is, since Greek antiquity. One sees how much, from the 18th to the 20th century, the hegemonism of possessing minorities, unveiled by Marx and Engels, and the anthropocentrism dismantled by Freud are accompanied by Europocentrism in the area of human and social sciences, and more particularly in those in direct relationship with non-European peoples. Abdelmelek sees Orientalism as having a history which, according to the Oriental of the late 20th century, led it to the impasse described above. Let us now briefly outline that history as it proceeded through the 19th century to accumulate weight and power, the hegemonism of possessing minorities, and anthropocentrism in alliance with Europocentrism. From the last decades of the 18th century and for at least a century and a half, Britain and France dominated Orientalism as a discipline. The great philological discoveries in comparative grammar made by Jones, Franz Bopp, Jakob Grimm, and others were originally indebted to manuscripts brought from the East to Paris and London. Almost without exception, every Orientalist began his career as a philologist, and the revolution in philology that produced Bopp, Sacy, Bourneuf, and their students was a comparative science based on the premise that languages belong to families, of which the Indo-European and the Semitic are two great instances. From the outset, then, Orientalism carried forward two traits. One, a newly found scientific self-consciousness based on the linguistic importance of the Orient to Europe. And two, a proclivity to divide, subdivide, and redivide its subject matter without ever changing its mind about the Orient as being always the same, unchanging, uniform, and radically peculiar object. Friedrich Schlegel, who learned his Sanskrit in Paris, illustrates these traits together. Although by the time he published his Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier in 1808, Schlegel had practically renounced his Orientalism, he still held that Sanskrit and Persian on the one hand, and Greek and German on the other, had more affinities with each other than with the Semitic, Chinese, American, or African languages. Moreover, the Indo-European family was artistically simple and satisfactory, in a way the Semitic, for one, was not. Such abstractions as this did not trouble Schlegel, for whom nations, races, minds, and peoples as things one could talk about passionately, in the ever-narrowing perspective of populism first adumbrated by Herder, held a lifelong fascination. Yet nowhere does Schlegel talk about the living, contemporary Orient. When he said in 1800, "It is in the Orient that we must search for the highest romanticism," he meant the Orient of the Sakuntala, the Zend Avesta, and the Upanishads. As for the Semites, whose language was agglutinative, unaesthetic, and mechanical, they were different, inferior, backward. Schlegel's lectures on language and on life, history, and literature are full of these discriminations, which he made without the slightest qualification. Hebrew, he said, was made for prophetic utterance and divination. The Muslims, however, espoused a dead, empty theism, a merely negative Unitarian faith. Much of the racism in Schlegel's strictures upon the Semites and other low Orientals was widely diffused in European culture. But nowhere else, unless it be later in the 19th century among Darwinian anthropologists and phrenologists, was it made the basis of a scientific subject matter as it was in comparative linguistics or philology. Language and race seemed inextricably tied, and the good Orient was invariably a classical period somewhere in a long-gone India, whereas the bad Orient lingered in present-day Asia, parts of North Africa, and Islam everywhere. Aryans were confined to Europe and the ancient Orient, as Leon Poliakov has shown, without once remarking, however, that Semites were not only the Jews, but the Muslims as well. The Aryan myth dominated historical and cultural anthropology at the expense of the lesser peoples. The official intellectual genealogy of Orientalism would certainly include Gobineau, Renan, Humboldt, Steinthal, Bourneuf, Remusat, Palmer, Weil, Dozy, Muir, to mention a few famous names almost at random from the 19th century. It would also include the diffusive capacity of learned societies. The Société Asiatique, founded in 1822, the Royal Asiatic Society, founded in 1823, the American Oriental Society, founded in 1842, and so on. But it might perforce neglect the great contribution of imaginative and travel literature, which strengthened the divisions established by Orientalists between the various geographical, temporal, and racial departments of the Orient. Such neglect would be incorrect, since for the Islamic Orient this literature is especially rich and makes a significant contribution to building the Orientalist discourse. It includes work by Goethe, Hugo, Lamartine, Chateaubriand, Kinglake, Nerval, Flaubert, Lane, Burton, Scott, Byron, Vigny, Disraeli, George Eliot, Gautier. Later, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, we could add Doughty, Barrès, Loti, T. E. Lawrence, Forster. All these writers give a bolder outline to Disraeli's great Asiatic mystery. In this enterprise, there is considerable support not only from the unearthing of dead Oriental civilizations by European excavators in Mesopotamia, Egypt, Syria, and Turkey, but also from major geographical surveys done all through the Orient. By the end of the 19th century, these achievements were materially abetted by the European occupation of the entire Near Orient, with the exception of parts of the Ottoman Empire, which was swallowed up after 1918. The principal colonial powers, once again, were Britain and France, although Russia and Germany played some role as well. To colonize meant, at first, the identification, indeed the creation, of interests. These could be commercial, communicational, religious, military, cultural. With regard to Islam and the Islamic territories, for example, Britain felt that it had legitimate interests as a Christian power to safeguard. A complex apparatus for tending these interests developed. Such early organizations as the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge, 1698, and the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, 1701, were succeeded and later abetted by the Baptist Missionary Society, 1792, the Church Missionary Society, 1799, the British and Foreign Bible Society, 1804, the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews, 1808. These missions openly joined the expansion of Europe. Add to these the trading societies, learned societies, geographical exploration funds, translation funds, the implantation in the Orient of schools, missions, consular offices, factories, and sometimes large European communities, and the notion of an interest will acquire a good deal of sense. Thereafter, interests were defended with much zeal and expense. So far, my outline is a gross one. What of the typical experiences and emotions that accompany both the scholarly advances of Orientalism and the political conquests aided by Orientalism? First, there is disappointment that the modern Orient is not at all like the texts. Here is Gérard de Nerval writing to Théophile Gautier at the end of August 1843. I have already lost, kingdom after kingdom, province after province, the more beautiful half of the universe, and soon I will know of no place in which I can find a refuge for my dreams. But it is Egypt that I most regret having driven out of my imagination, now that I have sadly placed it in my memory. This is by the author of a great Voyage en Orient. Nerval's lament is a common topic of Romanticism, the betrayed dream, as described by Albert Béguin in L'âme romantique et le rêve, and of travelers in the biblical Orient, from Chateaubriand to Mark Twain. Any direct experience of the mundane Orient ironically comments on such valorizations of it as were to be found in Goethe's Mahometsgesang or Hugo's Adieu de l'Hôtesse Arabe. Memory of the modern Orient disputes imagination, sends one back to the imagination as a place preferable for the European sensibility to the real Orient. For a person who has never seen the Orient, Nerval once said to Gautier, a lotus is still a lotus. For me, it is only a kind of onion. To write about the modern Orient is either to reveal an upsetting demystification of images culled from texts, or to confine oneself to the Orient of which Hugo spoke in his original preface to Les Orientales, the Orient as image or pensée, symbols of une sorte de préoccupation générale. If personal disenchantment and general preoccupation fairly map the Orientalist sensibility at first, they entail certain other more familiar habits of thought, feeling, and perception. The mind learns to separate a general apprehension of the Orient from a specific experience of it. Each goes its separate way, so to speak. In Scott's novel, The Talisman, 1825, Sir Kenneth, of the Crouching Leopard, battles a single Saracen to a standoff somewhere in the Palestinian desert. As the crusader and his opponent, who is Saladin in disguise, later engage in conversation, the Christian discovers his Muslim antagonist to be not so bad a fellow after all. Yet, he remarks, I well thought that your blinded race had their descent from the foul fiend, without whose aid you would never have been able to maintain this blessed land of Palestine against so many valiant soldiers of God. I speak not thus of thee in particular, Saracen, but generally of thy people and religion. Strange is it to me, however, not that you should have the descent from the evil one, but that you should boast of it. For indeed the Saracen does boast of tracing his race's line back to Iblis, the Muslim Lucifer. But what is truly curious is not the feeble historicism by which Scott makes the scene medieval, letting Christian attack Muslim theologically in a way 19th century Europeans would not. They would, though. Rather, it is the airy condescension of damning a whole people generally, while mitigating the offense with a cool, I don't mean you in particular. Scott, however, was no expert on Islam, although H.A.R. Gibb, who was, praised The Talisman for its insight into Islam and Saladin, and he was taking enormous liberties with Iblis's role by turning him into a hero for the faithful. Scott's knowledge probably came from Byron and Beckford, but it is enough for us here to note how strongly the general character ascribed to things Oriental could withstand both the rhetorical and the existential force of obvious exceptions. It is as if, on the one hand, a bin called Oriental existed into which all the authoritative, anonymous, and traditional Western attitudes to the East were dumped unthinkingly, while on the other, true to the anecdotal tradition of storytelling, one could nevertheless tell of experiences with or in the Orient that had little to do with the generally serviceable bin. But the very structure of Scott's prose shows a closer intertwining of the two than that. For the general category in advance offers the specific instance a limited terrain in which to operate. No matter how deep the specific exception, no matter how much a single Oriental can escape the fences placed around him, he is first an Oriental, second a human being, and last again an Oriental. So general a category as Oriental is capable of quite interesting variations. Disraeli's enthusiasm for the Orient appeared first during a trip east in 1831. In Cairo, he wrote, My eyes and mind yet ache with a grandeur so little in unison with our own likeness. General grandeur and passion inspired a transcendent sense of things and little patience for actual reality. His novel Tancred is steeped in racial and geographical platitudes. Everything is a matter of race, Sidonia states, so much so that salvation can only be found in the Orient and amongst its races. There, as a case in point, Druzes, Christians, Muslims, and Jews hobnob easily because, someone quips, Arabs are simply Jews on horseback, and all are Orientals at heart. The unisons are made between general categories, not between categories and what they contain. An Oriental lives in the Orient. He lives a life of Oriental ease, in a state of Oriental despotism and sensuality, imbued with a feeling of Oriental fatalism. Writers as different as Marx, Disraeli, Burton, and Nerval could carry on a lengthy discussion between themselves, as it were, using all those generalities unquestioningly and yet intelligibly. With disenchantment and a generalized, not to say schizophrenic, view of the Orient, there is usually another peculiarity. Because it is made into a general object, the whole Orient can be made to serve as an illustration of a particular form of eccentricity. Although the individual Oriental cannot shake or disturb the general categories that make sense of his oddness can nevertheless be enjoyed for its own sake. Here, for example, is Flaubert describing the spectacle of the Orient. To amuse the crowd, Muhammad Ali's jester took a woman in a Cairo bazaar one day, set her on the counter of a shop, and coupled with her publicly while the shopkeeper calmly smoked his pipe. On the road from Cairo to Shubra some time ago, a young fellow had himself publicly buggered by a large monkey, as in the story above, to create a good opinion of himself and make people laugh. A marabout died a while ago, an idiot, who had long passed as a saint marked by God. All the Muslim women came to see him and masturbated him. In the end, he died of exhaustion. From morning to night, it was a perpetual jacking off. Quid dicis of the following fact. Some time ago, a santon, ascetic priest, used to walk through the streets of Cairo completely naked, except for a cap on his head and another on his prick. To piss, he would doff the prick cap, and sterile women who wanted children would run up, put themselves under the parabola of his urine, and rub themselves with it. Flaubert frankly acknowledges that this is grotesquerie of a special kind. All the old comic business, by which Flaubert meant the well-known conventions of the cudgeled slave, the coarse trafficker in women, the thieving merchant, acquire a new, fresh, genuine, and charming meaning in the Orient. This meaning cannot be reproduced. It can only be enjoyed on the spot and brought back very approximately. The Orient is watched, since its almost but never quite offensive behavior issues out of a reservoir of infinite peculiarity. The European, whose sensibility tours the Orient, is a watcher, never involved, always detached, always ready for new examples of what the Description de l'Égypte called bizarre jouissance. The Orient becomes a living tableau of queerness. And this tableau quite logically becomes a special topic for texts. Thus, the circle is completed. From being exposed as what texts do not prepare one for, the Orient can return as something one writes about in a disciplined way. Its foreignness can be translated, its meanings decoded, its hostility tamed. Yet the generality assigned to the Orient, the disenchantment that one feels after encountering it, the unresolved eccentricity it displays, are all redistributed in what is said or written about it. Islam, for example, was typically Oriental for Orientalists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Karl Becker argued that although Islam, note the vast generality, inherited the Hellenic tradition, it could neither grasp nor employ the Greek humanistic tradition. Moreover, to understand Islam, one needed above all else to see it not as an original religion, but as a sort of failed Orientalist